I'm Frank Verastro. Good morning. I'm director of the Energy and National Security Program here at CSIS, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this session for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, I think the topic we're going to discuss this morning is extremely important. It's critical to our nation's future, but it's also really timely. As we talk about discussing the global challenges of climate change and energy security, gas plays an enormous role. And the success of natural gas drilling in this country over the last several years has reversed what we had as a decline and created a surplus, which has made a lot of folks in the policy community pretty complacent. I also need to tell you that outside we have the roadmap to the low carbon future, which talks about balancing security and climate change. And one of our recommendations is clearly to have a proactive position dealing with natural gas. Over the last several years, unconventional gas, or what we've known as unconventional gas, being tight sands, coal seam, and now the shales, they now account for about half of our domestic production. So the question is, you know, at some point, does the unconventional become the conventional? But there's a lot of challenges, and the different formations. I was with Tosco before I spent most of my career at Pennzoil, and shales are all different. And there's a lot of things, whether they're commercial, environmental, the business plan, the access, how you deal with the local communities, water resources. These are challenges that operators have to deal with every day. So I'm extremely encouraged that the panel we've selected for you today is outstanding in terms of addressing those issues, and I suspect it's going to be informative to most of you. Like most sessions that we have here, the entire session's on the record. We will post the slides as soon as they're available later on this afternoon. And the second reason why I'm really excited about today's session is the fact that we have Don Paul that's going to moderate and introduce and frame the session. Don was a senior executive at Chevron for 30 years. I had the pleasure of working with him on the National Petroleum Council study. He recently retired from Chevron, and at that point we offered him a position as a senior advisor here at CSIS, which he accepted. So we thought this would be a great time to roll him out in this vein to introduce today's session. In the interim period between joining CSIS, he's now also taken on additional responsibilities as head of the Energy Institute at the University of Southern California. And he's taken the Beck chair, or the Keck chair, rather, for energy resources. So it's my pleasure to introduce Don Paul, and I hope you all have an informative session and look forward to the discussion. Thank you all for coming.
Well, good morning, everyone. I appreciate all of you coming out. I think it'll be a very interesting session, and I certainly want to welcome our distinguished panel, which I think brings deep expertise in the areas of resources, technology, and the business associated with unconventional gas. What we're going to do this morning is I want to give a little bit of context before we start, and then Brent Pierce will talk about the resources. Brenda's with the U.S. Geological Survey. And I would encourage, by the way, all of you to look at the biographies which were available. Then Ron Hyden is the Strategic Business Manager of Production Enhancement for Halliburton. He's going to give us a deep dive into some of the key technologies that promote unconventional gas development. And then Julie Struble, who is the Vice President of Operations for Anadarko, one of the largest independent operators in the U.S., and will give you the business perspective as well. And then we'll have an extended period of time for discussion and Q&A. One of the challenges, of course, we always face in any discussion about energy, it's never about one thing. And I think it's always involves business and economics. It always involves technology. It always involves government policy and environment. And perhaps nowhere do you see all of these things come together in some ways in a complex and perhaps challenging fashion than in unconventional gas. And ultimately, decisions that companies make, the governments make, have to do with balancing the factors of environment, economic performance, and today, of course, energy security. One of the key aspects, I think, that gas represents in the hydrocarbon supply system for the globe is that it's, frankly, much less developed than the oil system. And Brenda's going to get into the gas resource issue, but I thought I'd just set this up a little bit by this little plot that was put out by USGS and adapted from the 2007 NPC report, which reflects, if you want to look at the big box there, as sort of the total molecule base, although even that, some would argue, is not included, does not include more exotic forms, which we won't get into. But what you see down in the little left-hand corner is we produced about 3,000 TCF to date, proved reserves, and of course these are resources that have been developed or identified to the point they can be produced with current technology and current economics, about double that at 6,000 TCF, and recoverable resources, again, these are estimated based on technical factors, at perhaps 15,000 TCF. So a very large resource base, much less developed than oil. And I think that's important when you think about the role gas would play in the future going forward. Today, to put it in perspective, you use about 100, the world uses about 100 TCF, actually a little bit more. So you're talking about a large in-place resource. Traditionally, of course, gas was constrained to regional and affect regional developments, developments that could be hardwired from production to use points with pipelines. The development of the global LNG market, the technology and the production and consumption markets built around LNG technology is globalizing gas. And over an extended period of time, it's very likely that this expansion will continue, and this brings the global factors associated with gas, supply, price, and so on, to play even for regionalized developments, and maybe we'll get into discussion about how these compete going forward. As Frank mentioned, we've seen a change of viewpoint about what can be developed. This slide shows the contrast between EIA's estimates in 2006 and then 2008 on the upper curves about the expected forward production curve for the U.S. and unconventional gas. And it shows a couple of key things. One, I think it shows that once resource opportunities are identified, technology and investments follow when conditions are right. The technology clearly continues to advance and, in effect, and I think you'll hear this from Julie, creates even more business investment opportunities. So it's a great technology resource, a success story. Of course, it's not without its challenges, and I think we'll get into some of this discussion later. That is, business plus technical plus policy and regulation. It's a natural resource development, and unlike some natural resource developments, it occurs in areas that perhaps have not seen such industrial-like development before. This raises local issues around land use management and, of course, many regulatory issues, and I hope we'll explore those. Today, of course, we see volatile pricing. I mean, if we had been having this conference 9 months ago, we would have had a different story, but that's, of course, the nature of the oil and gas business and has been for a long time. The other issue that I think we would get into is what is competition from major sources? As you could see, the resource base is quite large. If you think about what impact would the Arctic development and a major pipeline into the U.S., what would that do to the unconventional gas business, for example? What will LNG do as it globalizes in terms of structuring prices and use in the United States? And then last but certainly not least is the impending structure of carbon regulation. And clearly, being the least carbon intensive, gas has some things going for it, but nonetheless, carbon management is going to impact gas development as it does all of hydrocarbons. So with that, I think we should get back on our agenda and hear an in-depth discussion about the resource base from Brenda.
Thank you, Don, and thank you to CSIS for inviting the USGS here. We always appreciate talking about resource assessments and the resource base, which is one of our purviews. We actually provide some of the few publicly available oil and gas resource estimates of the world and the U.S. Just to set the stage, everybody in the room knows this. I know you know this, but why do we care? Obviously, energy consumption by every type of commodity is increasing, and all credible forecasts show that, both the U.S. and the world. And it's going to take everything, including energy efficiency, but it is going to take everything. And for the reasons that Don and Frank said, natural gas is obviously a very important, critical part of that. I show this, again, I think most of the people in this room know this, but I took just one sector of an energy potential, and this is the electrical sector. And so to show how it's broken out over time, and the domestic versus the world, so you can say, see, it does change over time, and everybody knows that, but it concretely changes over time. So this wedge is the coal component of the electrical generation from the 1970s to the 2000s. And that has stayed somewhat stable. It's about 49-50% now. It's also been pretty stable in the world, and it's growing. Now, these parts of the pie have changed, but remember, the pie is growing over time, too. This is all 100%. But if you look, things like petroleum has significantly lessened for electrical generation, and that makes sense. Petroleum's used for other things. There's more useful uses for petroleum, say. Surprisingly, things like hydro has significantly, will this work? Does this show on both? Yeah. Conventional hydroelectric was about 15.5% in the 70s in the U.S. It's about half that now. Same with the in the world, less so, but about 21% in the 70s and 16%. Environmental challenges, cost concerns with all choices. So that's what I think we have to keep in mind when we look at this. We're here to discuss natural gas, but it's all part of a larger picture. I'm not going to go through this. I put this in because the slides are going up later, so you can go back and reference this. This is natural consumption by end use, so you can look at what natural consumption in the U.S. by end use is. And obviously there are a lot of different uses, and they all compete with each other. So electric power, vehicle use, very small, but industrial, commercial, vehicle use has obviously been on certain people's minds for increasing. Where is it going to come from? What is it going to be competition for? Again, we're here to talk about domestic natural gas, but we have to keep it in a global context. We import some. We don't import as much as oil. But we took this map, and it's a little hard to see. I'm sorry. We took the NASA Earth at Night map, and so it shows you, now it's electrical, but it shows you the major consumers of electricity and, by extension, energy. And what we did was overlay our USGS resource estimates on top of that. And you'll see, and most people know this intuitively, that the large consumers are not always the large resource base. And so there is that disconnect, especially as the world and the U.S. Consumption grows and the demand grows. So that's something we have to keep in context, too, of challenges of importing, challenges of transporting, challenges of the environment, those kinds of things. Although there's a lot of resource. Again, let me use this. As Don said as well, there's easily, well, let me back up. What the USGS assesses, what these numbers mean, is we do undiscovered, technically recoverable resources. So undiscovered is those not in the reserve base. They're additive. Those are the resources that have the potential to become reserves. And we do technically recoverable. These are not economically recoverable. They may be, but they are technically recoverable with today's technology and industry practice. So to keep USGS numbers in mind, we do undiscovered, technically recoverable resource estimates. So of that, the world has about 5,500 TCF of undiscovered but technically recoverable resources, potential to become reserves. That's conventional only. There are very few undiscovered unconventional type numbers. There's some out there, but there's very little data. So that's conventional only. You can grow a lot if you add the unconventional. Conventional onshore, about 713, adds significantly to that if you talk about the unconventional. So let's turn to the U.S., which is the point of today. We took the USGS numbers, which is onshore, and state waters numbers, and then MMS does the outer continental shelf, and combine them together. And if you take unconventional and conventional onshore and state waters, our latest estimates, combining them all, is almost 750 trillion cubic feet of gas. So a significant amount. Remember, their challenge to this, they may not be economically recoverable. Some are stranded on the North Slope of Alaska, et cetera, but these are technically recoverable with today's technology. The MMS numbers, they're conventional only, so if we do unconventional offshore, you can add to this number, but it's 420 trillion cubic feet offshore. So just perspective, big potential, but they're not givens. So what does all this mean? U.S. has a long history of production activity. We all know that. This is just a map we put together of the production activity, historical activity, and you have oil, gas, et cetera. But there's still significant potential just in the U.S. alone, and there's for various reasons that I won't get into, but a lot of that is the unconventional resources. They truly are a part of the resource base, and we really have to look at them. How much will they become viable? What are the ones that will? What are the ones that aren't? What are economic? And our next few speakers will talk a lot about that. But just setting the stage of the resource base, they're a very important part of the energy potential. As you all know, they have grown over time. And I want to take just a minute to explain what they are. The USGS uses the term continuous instead of unconventional because, as Frank mentioned, some of them are no longer unconventional. To me, unconventional means uneconomic and not part of the resource base. So we have resources like coal bed methane, tight gas sands, that are no longer quote-unquote unconventional. So for resource assessment purposes, we call them continuous because geologically that's what they are. They are these resources that are continuous across a basin and distinct and different from the conventional traps like this, the stratigraphic and structural traps that we've produced for, you know, more than 100 years. They are not discrete water oil or water gas contacts like you have in these conventional. They're much more basin-centered, so you have basin-centered gas, you have tight gas sands. And the conventional resources have been formed at depth, have migrated up through the system, and so relatively speaking, they're much easier to produce because by definition they have migrated through the system. Whereas most of these continuous type accumulations are actually sourced here in the trap. They have not moved much, if anything, a very little bit. That gives challenges of production. It's harder to produce them. It's more expensive to produce them, and the other speakers will talk to that a little bit. So they're very distinct geologically, so we assess them differently, and they're very distinct in terms of production, the impact, all those kinds of things. And yet the unconventional gas can become conventional. We all know that coal bed methane now is an important part of our resource base. I think Don mentioned, or Frank mentioned, they're half of the domestic production now, all unconventionals. Coal bed methane is almost 10% of our natural gas production. I mean, it's a huge market displacement in just a very short period of time. 20 years ago, it was simply a hazard in coal mines. So it really does have the chance to displace the market and are very important. In 1995, the USGS mean estimate for the domestic coal bed methane resource was about 50 trillion cubic feet. Our current estimate for the domestic resource base for coal bed methane alone is almost 90 trillion cubic feet. So it's not that we were wrong, it's what is technically recoverable changes over time. And this is a growing resource. By the same token, if we look at all continuous type, or what people call unconventional, but not unconventional like hydrates. So this is just the continuous type of resources that are today technically recoverable and have the potential to be added to reserves. There is about 364 trillion cubic feet of gas onshore in state waters, U.S., in our estimate. There is some of that includes coal bed methane on the North Slope of Alaska. Obviously, it's stranded, but again, it's technically recoverable using today's technology. If you compare that to our 1995 assessment of all continuous gas, of what was technically recoverable at the time, it was only 2 TCF. So huge difference. So this is technically recoverable. Again, whether it's economically recoverable, at what environmental cost, economic cost, is a different matter. This is the resource base. And now just to take you through a few of the examples, the Barnett Shale. Everybody's heard about the Barnett Shale. Second largest reserve in the United States now, second only to the San Juan Basin. It has really kind of set the way for these types of resources in many ways. 2003 Barnett Shale production had about 1,900 vertical wells in it. You had these areas, the Newark East Field especially. It's the Newark East Field, which is the second largest field in the United States, next only to San Juan Basin. Compare this to 2008, which has about 8,000 wells, about half of them horizontal. So huge difference in technology. Compare these, 2003, 2008. Just huge growth in this type of resource and the production in the Barnett Shale. I mean, it just vaulted to the second in terms of reserves, and it makes a huge difference. And I think it's why everybody's excited about this type of resource. But as Don and Frank said, maybe it's not comparable. I mean, different shales are unique. And so this one type of shale may not be comparable to others. I mean, you have to look at all of them. We assess them We assess them the same, but it's what's technically recoverable for that type of shale. So it's important to keep in mind they're not all created equal. There's a lot of excitement about this one. Is it applicable to others? The Barnett, just a bar chart of Barnett Shale natural gas production. I didn't update this. I just have the numbers from the first quarter of 2008. But look at this explosive growth. So this is production. So this one does cause excitement. You've heard others, the Marcellus Shale. Don actually brought Ron brought an example of the Woodford Shale. So afterwards, come up and look at it. It's a very different animal than conventional resources with the pore-filling hydrocarbons. But Marcellus Shale has taken off as well. And this isn't just gas. It's also oil. And I know we're not here to talk about oil, but I wanted to use this example because the Barnett Shale technology was transferred to a formation called the Bakken. And most of you have probably heard about the Bakken. It's, we get multiple emails a day about it. In 1995, we assessed the Bakken formation and found that about 150 million barrels of oil was technically recoverable at that time. We reassessed it less than a year ago in last April, and in our reassessment, we found that 3.65 billion barrels of oil is now technically recoverable. Again, we didn't necessarily get it wrong. There's only been about 200 million barrels produced to date from the Bakken. What now makes a difference in what's technically recoverable is an improved geologic understanding. They've actually had some finds in the Bakken since that time, but the really big factor is that technology difference. Technology from the Barnett Shale was taken up to the Bakken, the fracking, the horizontal wells, and it's what's making this now technically recoverable and economically recoverable. So those kinds of things make a huge difference in the resource base, and that's what we have to keep in mind. Now, I want to just briefly talk about gas hydrates. This truly is unconventional, but I want to throw it in to set the stage for something. We've seen how coal bed methane, we've seen how tight gas sands and shale gas have changed over time and is now an economic viable part of our resource base. So I just want to talk very briefly about gas hydrates and perhaps what's on the horizon. What are gas hydrates? They're actually solid methane and water. They're not necessarily frozen because a lot of the temperatures are above freezing, but they're solid methane. And what happens at depth when it solidifies, it forms a mineral called a clathrate. But what happens at depth is that it highly concentrates the methane gas. And so it's found under subsea areas offshore. The red dots are where they're found. And under Arctic permafrost areas. Obviously, you have to have a gas source, and you have to have the right temperature and pressure conditions. But when you have hydrates, if you have a cubic volume of a hydrate at depth, you bring it to surface temperature and pressure, it is 160 times that amount of gas as was found at depth. It just holds tremendous amount of gas, and that's why people are excited about it, because there really is a potential there. Can we produce it, and at what cost? That's the question. Hydrates, like every other petroleum reservoir, oil and gas reservoir, depends upon the geology of it. This is a shale or a mud versus a sand, and it's hugely different. We're right now focusing primarily on the sands. So we're looking at this is it a viable future resource? The concentrations are much higher. You can get 70 to 90% concentrations of the hydrate, and remember, that's 160 times natural gas at surface temperature and pressure. I think the exciting thing about hydrates is that in the last few years, there have been some major landmark advances. There have been three gas hydrate production tests, two at Malik, and one at Mount Elbert. The Malik one was in cooperation with a variety of partners, with the Geologic Survey of Canada, the Japanese. Mount Elbert was BP Exploration Alaska and DOE-led. And these, all three of them, actually had gas produced from the solid phase with conventional technology. There were novel applications to the technology, but nothing was built for this purpose. nothing developed specifically for this. It was conventional technology, and that's the important thing. So there are some deposits that are technically recoverable, and that's very important, major steps forward. So as a result, the USGS was able to do actually a technically recoverable resource estimate of the gas hydrates on the North Slope of Alaska. We used the same type of methodology we do for our conventional assessments, and we were able to do it just in this one area because of the intense seismic lines that we have on the North Slope of Alaska because of conventional oil and gas, as well as these production tests that we've had. So we have the engineering data. There's a modeling effort led by DOE that helped us understand those types of production on the North Slope of Alaska. And so going through our normal process, we found that a mean estimate, sorry for this mouse, there is 85.4 trillion cubic feet of technically recoverable gas from gas hydrates on the North Slope of Alaska. I mean, that's a tremendous amount. The U.S. uses about 22, 24 a year. I don't want to oversell this. This may not be economic to produce. We need a long-term production test to look at the long-term implications. But some gas hydrates now is technically recoverable. So I just want to put that on the radar screen. We're here to talk more about the tight gas sands, shale gas. But if we're really going to look at energy and dialogue about the future, I think we have to include that as an unconventional. It may actually have potential to become conventional, hopefully, someday. Thank you.
Brenda, thank you very much. Gave us a look at the geology, and I think we're going to take the next step with Ron and move on and talk about the engineering and the application in practice of technology to the development of these resources.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing us to come here today and talk about the technology for the unconventional resources. Of course, just a comment again from the oil and gas investor, the hottest play going right now, obviously, is the shale, and that brings up this conversation. If you look at, again, at the shale map, and I think Brenda covered this fairly well, you can see the shale plays across the U.S. are fairly extensive, so we have a lot of opportunities to play. Some of the recent ones, just to give you an idea of the scope, looking at the Marcellus, for example, typical looking at 4,000 to 8,000 foot of depth, something around 1,500 to 5,000 psi, bottom hole pressures and temperatures at 100 to 150 degrees. And then we go to the other end of the spectrum, looking at the Haynesville Shale in East Texas and North Louisiana. And here we see depths on the order of, let's see if I can get my deal here, 10,000 to 13,000 feet, 6 to 15,000 psi. And look at the temperatures, 310 degrees F. So my point is we've got a wide range of shales, and we've got a wide range of where they exist, all the way from fairly safe or low temperatures to some pretty high temperatures and high-pressure activity. And the shales that we have in the U.S. usually fall in between those two ends. The shale itself, and I did bring an example of the Woodford Shale, the shale itself is just like anything else. It's a rock. We're not playing in some kind of an open cavern. It's a solid rock. And so we have a scanning electron microscope then of a typical shale, and we noticed, and I just did it. I used the term typical shale when in reality there's nothing typical about it. Each one of these things has a different mineralogy and different components, and we have to account for that when we try to do stimulation treatments to improve productivity. And we wind up studying these things all the way down to the molecular level to try to understand exactly what reactions are going on and trying to understand then how to successfully stimulate. Just for a point of note, on the Barnett Shale that she showed the graph, that Barnett Shale was laying up there, and we were fracking it back in the 80s, and we were not very successful commercially. I mean, we could put the frack job away, but the wells would not commercially produce. So for a decade, we sat there trying conventional fracturing treatments, and were very unsuccessful. Mitchell Energy at the first was one of the first players up there. And I was running an operations in East Texas and sending equipment and chemicals over, and I was one of the designers of the original work. And we would do what was done successfully in conventional sand traps and worked every time, like the Cotton Valley. I send that exact same treatment over to the Barnett, and I can place a frack job, but we do not make commercial production. So here's a big distinction. The unconventional is not given the name unconventional because it's the smaller volume of produced gas. It's unconventional because the rock is different. It is not inert. It is an active player in holding that hydrocarbon. So the chemistry involved in it is not the same chemistry as the carbonates and the sandstones we've been playing with for decades. And that is that's an incredibly important point if you're going to design well construction and stimulation treatments that will make the reservoir commercially producible. And again, Exhibit A is the Barnett. Look at the efforts, pull the records on the 1980s, the 1990s, and look at the 2000s, and look at the difference between the chemistry and the well construction, and you see the story about why it was called unconventional. And it's not because it made a smaller volume of gas. It's because the rock is fundamentally different. And until companies like ours got our minds around that difference and went to our PhDs and our chemists and asked them, what do I do? What is different about that scanning electron microscope than one of a trapped sand? Only then did we start to discover, well, what can I do to make the production commercially viable from that reservoir? When we look at these, as Brenda pointed out, one of the first things everybody comments is, we know the Barnett's successful. These other shales look kind of the same, but not really. I can see something's going on. Is it a Barnett-class shale? That's the first question that always comes out. Is this a Barnett? And so we wind up taking core samples and looking at geochemistry to understand, yes, no, kind of how. How's it related? How's it different? And what does that mean for stimulation? What does that mean for economic survival of that field? And so we're constantly looking at some way to do a typecast of what's a Barnett chemically, how does it look, and then how does any other sample look, and a comparison for pros and cons and some comparison. So the message to take away here that I really want to convey is every shale is different, and they all have their uniqueness, and you have to be aware of that uniqueness and cater to it to be commercially successful on the production side. Just a comment real quick, I don't know how deep to go into this subject, but basically, another takeaway message I want you to get from this, hydraulic fracturing was actually invented by Stanley and Oil Company in 1947. They played with it for a couple of years, finally kind of got it worked out, and then licensed it, and the first licensee was Halliburton in 1949. So we've been playing commercially with hydraulic fracturing for 60 years. Now, I joined the company in 1979, so this is my 30th year. When I joined the company in 1979, the production enhancement department was the single largest business unit at Halliburton, and it has been that way ever since. I suspect it was that way before I got there. Sometime in the early 70s or late 60s, pressure pumping at Halliburton was the dominant industry or the dominant business unit. So my message is hydraulic fracturing on these unconventionals is absolutely not new. We've been doing hydraulic fracturing all along for decades. The issue is, for the shale gas, we had to learn how to adapt our chemistry and our processes for the uniqueness of the shale. And for you guys to get into it fairly close, one large uniqueness is most sand and carbonates, when we fracture them, have a single dominant layer that has a finite definition, something on the order of an inch of width and some footage of length on the order of 500 to 700 feet of length. And the defined height is something that's usually defined, that height, the interval in a vertical well, is usually defined by the rock property layers bounding it, okay? So we very much know dimensions of what those fractures do, and the conventional ones were fairly easy to model. The shales are anything but easy to model. They are complex. They're just a nest of fractures, and they have varying sizes and dimensions, but I will point out, in general, they have something of a defined width and a defined length and a defined height. They're just wider. There's a nest of them rather than one single one. And that's a big difference in the fracturing world to understand that. This is just a kind of a schematic, an overlay of two horizontal wellbores laying side by side in a top view looking down and a conception of how those fractures might be nested. So there's not one single planar sheet of paper laying down there. This is a nest, and we're working to that nest. Okay? Now, A big understanding is that if I design a frac treatment to fill this type of fracture model, I will have a defined rate and a pressure of a certain size and volume. But if I'm going after a nest or a large area, then what's going to happen is that rate that pump rate is going to go way up, because actually what I'm doing is imparting as much energy into that rock face as I can to break it up. I'm looking at breaking up the rock because I'm trying to increase the surface area exposed of the rock, and that's a key fundamental statement about commercial viability of its production. Now, basically what that means is, over time, if I'm driving my rate up, that means I'm using larger volumes of water. Okay, so here comes the key element or difference from conventional to unconventional, that I will use a lot of the same material and the same equipment. When you drive by location, the same trucks will be parked and the same chemicals up on the van are a lot of similar basic chemicals, but you're going to find some unique characters that address the uniqueness of the shale, and you're also going to look around and find that I'm using more water than I did in the conventional work. And so that's an issue. That's a point that we have to think about. As we go forward and understand then these differences, clearly we can see things that are coming at us that would be improvements that we should do for the industry. One of them is to look at the concept of reusing water. If I'm using small volumes in a discrete treatment, then when I first started with the company, the thought of having a limited supply of potable water never crossed my mind. Go to the local well, get all the water you need, and go. But as time goes by and we start using larger volumes of water, you can't make that assumption. And so it'd be quite reasonable to be proactive and think about, well, how could I reuse water? How could I treat with it, flow it back, treat it somehow, and use it again? How could I do this cycle over and over again? And so at Halliburton, we have initiated several programs to look at environmental improvements, one of those being how do we do a stronger effort at either using produced water as a source stream rather than potable water, or consider the concept of recycling. And so we're engaged in that evolution now and looking at different types of equipment that might accomplish that. One of the other interesting things that we get into, if you're dealing with small volumes of water, it's one thing to use chemicals. You use anything you need to get the treatments done. One of the aspects on treatments on water usage is to keep the bacteria count in the water down. There's two reasons for that. Bacteria messes up my chemistry that I'm trying to engage downhole, and it also has a detrimental effect on some reservoirs. Bacteria introduced in some reservoirs can introduce sulfate-reducing bacteria and, in essence, evolve H2S gas, and, of course, we don't want to do that. So treating bacteria is important. One of the greatest bacteria control agents is bleach, the same material you have in your household. But that is expensive. You're spending money, and you have these large volumes of bleach if you're using large volumes of water. One of the best ideas that we saw come across the line was the idea of flipping over and using ultraviolet light to kill bacteria. And so at Halliburton, we piloted that program as well. And in fact, the first truck that can do this type of service is rolled out within the last couple of weeks in East Texas to prove out this concept of doing a mechanical operation and taking a chemical option off the table. So technology development that way. Now, in terms of technologies that have been deployed and successful that have already been successful, for example, in bringing like the Barnett and other shale plays up to commercial viability. We'll just hit those really quick. In all three phases, from discovery, development, to decline, you see these technologies evolve. Right off the bat, you take that geochemical knowledge about the differences of the shales, and once you identify those and the strengths and weaknesses, you take that information to the open hole logging companies. We have that business unit as well, and you give that chemical description to the open hole loggers and ask them, tell me the type of test or tool that you would run to pick out these uniquenesses and color code the darn things. Make it very visible to me as a design engineer what exactly is in the reservoir, and help me pick out which type of reservoir am I dealing with, so I know very quickly which play program to run to based on the description of the play. And the next part, in the development phase, again, looking at what these fractures are doing and growing, we have a challenge. One of those challenges is to visualize or understand the size and the scope of the fracture. But in some cases, like the Haynesville, with those high temperatures, you have a real problem trying to get the mechanics deployed at 300 degrees plus. And so it's a challenge to us to take something that was successful at lower temperatures, like a microseismic sensing, and apply that to a higher temperature range. So that's one of the technology advanced areas that we work with constantly, finding something that works and then taking that technology to higher and higher temperatures and pressures so that we can work in reservoirs that are deeper. One of the other interesting things that I saw coming across the line was the idea of taking the cuttings from the drilling rig, take that cutting and do more analysis on it to really confirm that the drill bit is in the pay zone. It's one thing to interpret seismic and lay out a complex trajectory and walk over to a directional driller and say, here, drill this plan. And they will drill that plan exactly the way you handed it to them. The question is, was there anything off in the seismic interpretation? And if they put that exact structure down hole, they may be outside of the pay interval. What you want is some exhibit A, some evidence that, yes, I am in the pay zone, I can prove it, and I'll do it while the bit's drilling. And so one quick way to do that is in a cuttings analysis. On the development phase, we've all talked about hydraulic fracturing. I think you've seen a lot about that, about multi-stage hydraulic fracturing. You've seen hydraulic fracturing adopted for horizontal well construction. Those have been done. They're very successful. The chemical adaptions that we have done is development in surfactants to try to take advantage of or at least serve better this idea of a reactive rock that wants to react with the fluids that you're pumping and make sure that we're using materials that are conducive to production rates. That's one of the chemicals that we talk about here in this GasPerm 1000, for example. And then, of course, as we work with these horizontals, for example, we look for different ways to drive up our efficiency to get our fracture treatments placed quicker in a shorter period of time. And one of the mechanical developments was the idea of using sliding sleeves, this delta stem sleeve type completion. So once you understand the mechanics of how to efficiently produce so well to get the commercial viability up, then we're all about improving the technology to drive up that efficiency. And then last but not least, in the decline phase, one of the things we recognize is that over the life of many reservoirs, as the gas production or oil production comes down, water production goes up, and again, you have a water production issue and a water disposal issue, and we looked at chemistries then to try to impede that water production from the reservoir in the longer life of the well, so that we try to catch the reservoir and hold the brine water in place and not produce it back to the surface. So all of these are issues about improving the technology and improving the commercial viability of a field all the way through its life, from discovery all the way through maturity. And then the last component is we're always looking at better theoretical models to understand both the geochemistry and then the complex fracturing itself. So those are ongoing developments as time goes by. Okay?
Thank you. Thank you, Ron. Certainly a deep dive into the technical aspects. I think for a lot of people who haven't seen this before, maybe even surprised at how technically sophisticated the development of these resources is. And Julie is going to give us a talk now about, from the business perspective, how you take the technology and put it into a functioning business model.
Thank you very much. Good morning, and can everybody hear me? Can everybody see me? We had a little problem when I first got in here, and I have my heels on today by design. What I'm going to do today is I'm actually going to walk you through a little bit of – oops, we went down to the wrong one. Go back to home. I'm going to walk you through a little bit about the decision process and the critical factors that independent companies like Anadarko have to address whenever we're looking into entering any kind of shale gas play or any kind of unconventional play. And what I want to start off with, and it's kind of odd that the three of us have a very common theme as we go through this presentation today, and we did not collaborate. Brenda and I talked a little bit about this slide, you know, what kind of resource sizes she was going to be showing versus what I was going to be showing, because there's a lot of variance in that right now that's not a known. There's not a lot of accuracy in it. But that's about the only thing we collaborated on, and you'll see that we do have some very, very common themes, which was nice to hear and see. But the first thing that a company like us, like Anadarko, looks for is what we call the size of the prize. And if you look at this slide, we're only looking at maybe four of the shale gas plays that are active today. And you take the total resource available, so what's in place, and then you also look at the potential recoverable reserves or resources out there, and you're talking TCFs. And that is not only alluring, it's compelling. It's very interesting. Companies like Anadarko really want to get a piece of something like this because the size of the prize is so large. What this slide doesn't address, though, is the risk associated with a shale gas play. Brenda and Ron both have talked a little bit about that, but what I want to delve into a little bit more is the fact that conventional plays versus unconventional like shale gas, what the real difference is in risk. In a conventional play, one of the main risks is whether or not you're going to find any hydrocarbons at all, any gas at all. In an unconventional play like the shale gas play, that's a very low risk. In fact, it's like zero risk. There is gas there. These shales are the source rocks for the conventional reservoirs. So what's the problem? You know, what is so difficult then about developing these shale gas plays? Well, it's because they have different risks, and those risks are more technical and more commercial. And what I'm going to try to do is break it down into four categories of risk for you. Again, both Brenda and Ron mentioned that there's no two shale plays that are alike. So just because we have the Barnett, which is the poster child for shale plays right now, does not mean that it's a cookie-cutter approach that you can take from what you learned in the Barnett and bring it to any other shale play. They're all different. The second category of risk is that even within the same shale gas play, you're going to have variability. And we talked about size of some of these plays, and it's real important because of this variability that you got to get a lot of swings at the bat. It's a statistical play. And what we mean by that is you can't use your conventional tools that you did in some of the conventional plays to determine what's the where is the best place to drill, where are you going to find your best wells. The way you do it in a shale gas play is you drill and you drill and you drill, and that's how you find your sweet areas and that's how you find your poor areas. So you have to have a large acreage position to begin with, and then you have to be committed for long term to be able to drill as many wells as you're going to need to balance the good and the bad, so on average you have a commercial play. The third category of risk, though, is the technical side. It's drilling these horizontal wells. What we've determined a shale gas play is going to be its most commercial, its most productive if you go into a horizontal development program. There's more cost associated with that on the drilling side. As Ron showed, there's pressure issues in some of the plays. It makes it more expensive. On the stimulation side, he's walked through how complicated some of that can be. Now, the fourth category of risk is maybe one that we don't normally talk about, but it's very real for these shale gas plays, and it's a sustained natural gas price environment that's above the economic threshold. In order to actually achieve a lot of the technical advantages that we need to crack the code on these shale gas plays, you have to have the right price for it. I'm going to use the Barnett as a type as we go through here, and I'm going to tell you a little bit of history about it, which has, again, already been addressed to a certain degree. But Mitchell drilled the first well back in 1981, which Ron was involved in, and that's pretty interesting to know. It wasn't really, though, until about 1990 when we started seeing some material production come out of the Barnett Shale. And at that time, prices were sub $2 per MMBTU. It took about 10 years. Shale production or gas production in the Barnett Shale languished till about 2000, sometime after 2000. At that time is when you saw gas prices actually crack that barrier of $4 per MMBTU. And what that meant is that companies now could focus some of their money towards research, partner with the Halliburtons, et cetera, of the energy industry, and try to spend more time, more focus on cracking the code. Once we had that threshold, that economic threshold reach, we could then begin that. And you saw production take off in the Barnett. Now, we're looking at 19 years later, and the Barnett's making, I think, on the order of 5 BCF a day. That may be the peak for Barnett. And the reason why I say that is in the last 6 months, reality has bitten us. We were in October, November, about $6.50 per MMBTU, somewhere around there. In the Barnett Shale, they were running over 200 rigs at that time. Mid-February, we're looking at $4.50 per MMBTU gas. The rig count in the Barnett's down to 120. It's dropped over 40%. And what you're going to see, and I've got a visual here to kind of drive this point home, the type of production declines that you see with these shale gas plays, very, very tight, is you'll get a high initial rate and you're going to drop off very quickly. with that big of a rig drop, and we're not even sure that's the end of the rig drop in the Barnett, you're going to see a dramatic decline at some point here soon in the Barnett production. So we probably have peaked at 5 BCF a day. So it's been a pretty long, it's been a pretty arduous journey for the Barnett Shale. Now what I'm going to do is take you on a, I keep hitting end, sorry about that. I'm going to take you on a much shortened journey, at least I'm going to try to. If you take it from the viewpoint of a company like Anadarko, looking at the potential size of the prize, TCFs, but also realizing all the difficulties that we're going to have to make this a commercial. So you're actually looking kind of like down a highway. And down that highway, as you embark on this project, you've got different exit points. I'm going to walk you through this. The very first part of it, though, is the identification of the shale play. You know, where you start out, we've got a shale gas opportunity here. We need to go out and capture. In this particular scenario, I'm going to say that we're going to capture 100,000 acres. As we discussed earlier, it's got to be a large position. You've got to have a lot of swings at the bat. On average, we're going to pay about $200 an acre. I think a lot of you have heard some of the shale plays going for as high as $20,000 an acre. Unbelievable. But early on, if you can get in quick enough and you're quiet enough about it, you can get it at fairly low dollar per acre prices. So right off the bat, a company will expose, and this is risk exposure, about $20 million in this particular scenario. And that's money that you put out on the table, and it's sunk. And if you decide that this play doesn't look like something that you want to pursue any further, you've lost that money. You don't get one dime back on it. Now the next, there we go. The next stage or the next off-ramp that you've got is the vertical pilot program. This is where you really, though, start to have a lot of fun because you're partnering with the Halliburtons. You're taking whole cores. This is your science project right here. You're drilling the vertical wells. You're getting pieces of the rock. You're looking at it. Some of these shale intervals are 300, 700 feet thick. And what you see within that shale interval is a lot of variability. And what you're trying to understand is what type of shale this is, how is it going to respond to certain fluids, what are you going to target for your horizontal lateral? You've got lots of choices here, so you're going to play a lot in the labs with a lot of the work here. You're going to do some experimentation in the field as well. You'll do some different type frac jobs. But again, this is just a learning phase. If your results from the vertical pilot are encouraging enough, you're going to take it to the next stage, which is the horizontal. So now you're taking the work from the lab and actually bringing it out into the field, and you're going to start experimenting. You're going to experiment with how long the laterals are going to be. Are you going to drill a 2,000-foot lateral or a 6,000-foot lateral? And that's a big decision because there's a lot of money associated with the difference between 2,000 and 6,000. What types of fracs are you going to perform? How big are the fracs going to be? Some of these, in the longer laterals, you'll have 10 or more separate fracs, and these are large fracs that can cost about $250,000 apiece. So you're doing a lot of your commercializing experimentation in the horizontal well program. Now, during this time, I don't want to belittle any of this, but during both the horizontal and the vertical pilot programs, there's a lot of work going on in the background, behind the scenes. Because when you take these leases out, they're for a finite period of time. And if you don't develop those leases within that time period, you lose them. So it's very difficult to try to dot all your I's and cross all your T's before you make that decision to go in full field development. You've got to be ready when you make that decision for full field development to hit the ground running. So we'll have teams, we'll have quite a bit of manpower assigned to the regulatory side. You've got local, you've got state, and in some areas you have federal agencies that you have to deal with, and it can be quite complex, the coordination. As you have probably heard, there's a lot of issues around water, water sourcing, water disposal. All those things have to be addressed. And in some of these areas that the shale plays are actually beginning new plays, the regulatory processes, the permitting processes, have not been worked through. It can take 9 months sometimes to get a permit for one well. That's one well. And when you're talking about thousands of wells, it takes a long time. Now, so you've got to try to get to the point where you've got the process streamlined to where you can at least get it in 30 days, get a one-well permit in 30 days. So that's going on behind the scenes. Another thing is your marketing infrastructure. You've got to be able to find a way to gather the gas. You've got to be able to find a way to get the gas out into the market and sold. Sometimes you need 1 to 2 years just lead time for that. You've got to buy the pipe. You've got to lay the pipe. You've got to find somebody that's willing maybe to build a brand-new pipeline, a bigger pipeline out of the area. All of that work has to be done a little bit in advance. And then there's the services infrastructure. A lot of the new plays that we're seeing are in areas where you don't really have the Halliburton set up. You don't have the rig crew set up. You don't have all the subcontractors associated with that. So before you actually go into full field development, you're going to have to figure out how you're going to do this. So you have to start working with all of these agencies. And that requires time and that requires manpower. Now, what you're trying to get to is the full field development, and this is where you're driving down your costs, this is where you're driving in your efficiencies, and this is where you're trying to maximize your recoveries from the well. Now, at any point along this highway, a company can decide that they want to exit, because what they found out is that the ultimate goal, which is value generation, you can call it commercial success, is just not attainable. And the main point that I wanted to drive home with this slide is that shale gas doesn't have a lot of hydrocarbon risk associated with it, but it has a lot of financial risk associated with it. And that's what companies like us are looking at, that we could spend as much as $100 million or more on a project and decide that we cannot make it commercial and we have to walk. And that's why it's very important when I talked about that fourth category of risk that we have a sustained gas price environment above the threshold so that we can make these decisions with confidence and know that we can carry through all the way to the end point, which is commercial success. The next thing I'm going to talk about is a little bit of the economic criteria that companies like us utilize to make the decisions of even starting the journey to begin with and then whether or not we're going to stay on the highway or we're going to exit. And this is a really simplified, again, we're using things from the Barnett program, so it's a type well type program from the Barnett. We're assuming that we are going to drill about 1,000 wells. For this particular instance, we're also assuming that the gas price environment is $6.50 per MMBTU, and I'll show you a sensitivity to that in a second. But what we're seeing is we're going to run about 10 rigs to drill the 1,000 wells. The blue bars in through here are the annual capital investment that a company is going to make. So this is for that 100,000 acres. We're actually saying we're probably only going to develop about 80,000 of those acres. It's very difficult to be able to commercially develop every single acre. But on the order of $300 to $350 million is spent each year, and it takes us about 9 years to get through this program. Again, this is in millions of dollars. I'm sorry I didn't explain that. The black curve, though, is the economic driver for companies like us. It's the cumulative after-tax discounted cash flow. And what we're looking at is how long is it going to take us to continue to spend capital each year before we start making more money than we're actually investing. In this particular scenario, we start getting positive discounted cash flow in year six. Another criteria that we looked at is how long is it going to take to pay the entire project down. So where that line actually crosses the zero line, which is about year 11, is how long it takes 11 years to pay out this particular project. If you want to summarize it all, we're going to invest about $2.8 billion, hard to get my head around that, in this project to drill 1,000 wells. The discounted cash flow, the return to us, is going to be about $330 million. Our profit-to-investment ratio, about 0.18. Well, what is that? What does that really mean? For every dollar that we invest, we're going to make a profit of 18 cents on this, and that's what we're looking at. And we have to compare it to other projects within our portfolio. And this is actually run unrisked. We're looking at that there's no risk associated in this at all, so it's a success case. What happens then when you have an environment like we've just gone through the past few months, and all of a sudden you're no longer in a 650 world? Now you're in a sub-5 world, and you may even end up being in a sub-4 world. What we've seen happen... How many times am I going to do that? It's my eyes. I can't see as well as I used to. Okay. This is a list of what Anadarko considers their peers, and we're on this list as well. And what we're looking at is what these companies have announced as their 2009 capital budget relative to what they spent in 2008. Okay, and this is probably about a month-old data. We don't know whether this is the end or not. But on average, just looking at these companies that we follow, there was a 30% reduction in how much they were going to invest in 2009 compared to what they spent in 2008. So if we take that into our Barnett-type shale gas program and we say, okay, we don't have as much money to invest anymore. We're going to have to reduce it by 30%. So instead, to drill this 1,000 wells, we're not going to have a peak rig count of 10. We're going to have a peak rig count of 7. Okay, so you see we're spending about a little bit south of $200 million a year. The discounted cash flow cumulative is in the black. And so what's the difference between a program at 450? And again, we assume that that 450 is static throughout the whole time period. In the 650 case, we started generating positive cash flow in year six. Here, year eight, not that big of a difference, really not that big of a difference. This is where you get start seeing some major discrepancies. Now, instead of 11 years to pay out the project, it's 21 years. And then when you summarize, in this particular scenario, since we're using a lower gas price, we're also using a lower capital cost environment, assuming that cost will go down. Now, we're assuming that that happens from day one, and that doesn't. You know that there's a lag associated with that, and that's what our industry is fighting right now. Low gas prices, yet still high capital costs. But we've adjusted the total investment to reflect historically the relationship we've seen between drop in prices and drop in capital costs. So instead of $2.8 billion, we're only going to spend $2.2. Still a lot of money. Discounted cash flow now drops from 330 to about 45. So your equivalent profit to investment is 0.04. So for every dollar invested, we're going to get 4 cents back. It's huge. Again, this is a success case. This has no risk included in it. Now, I mentioned earlier about the type wells with the Barnett and what kind of impact the price environment has on the rig counts, and then as the rig counts drops, what happens to total production from the field. And you got to really go back to the basics. This is one well. Initially, this well, on average, would produce about 1.6 million a day. There we go, 1.6 million a day. And the very first year is a rapid decline because these gas wells are so tight, you're producing from shale, that it cannot sustain that high rate for very long. It will drop down. So in the first year, you see about a 60% decline rate. And even though this is for the Barnett, we're seeing this pretty much carry over to all shale plays. This is probably the only thing that they have in common, is a steep decline in the first year. By the end of the second year, you had a third of what your initial rate was. So you see dramatic decline. You take this one well, you multiply it by 1,000, you put it into a program. And I've shown both the 650 and the 450 cases, but they both indicate the same thing. Once you stop, once you've drilled those 1,000 wells and you start laying down rigs, whether it's from 10 or from 7, you see a very dramatic fall off in the total production from the field. That's what we're going to see in the Barnett. The other thing that I want to show in here, a little bit of different highlight I wanted to make, is that if the company still decides that they're going to pursue the shale gas, even though they're only getting 4 cents on the dollar for profit, what impact it has on supply, what impact it has on consumers, is that in that 10-year period, you're providing 250 to 300 BCF less of gas. So you've created a gap there. The final slide, I know you're excited about that, is I'm going to go back to the size of the prize, but we're looking at it a little bit different way. Size of the prize that gets us excited at first from an independent company standpoint is the TCFs and the prospect for commerciality. But in reality, the shale gas plays have a lot more far-reaching benefit, whether it's the local economy, whether it's the state economy, or as you multiply these shale gas plays across the U.S., it's the national economy. So for all of us, having a sustained gas price that's above a threshold has a lot of benefit. And we can see, you know, particularly from this, what kind of contribution the Barnett Shale has had. And that concludes my presentation. If we want to open up to questions. Or
well, I think that we've heard very knowledgeable viewpoints about the key issues of geology, technology, and then commerciality. And one of the things I guess I'd want to ask the panelists and then open it up for audiences is when you look at the intensity of this kind of operation where you're drilling thousands of given trend development, thousands of wells, and for people on the outside, this in fact amounts to the industrialization of an area that may not have been industrialized before. And I think one of the questions that ask is how does a company like Anadarko
balance and communicate that with, particularly in areas, in areas where you haven't seen this kind of development. Texas is a little bit different than working in New York or Pennsylvania, or at least it's been a long time since they've had major oil development in Pennsylvania. So how do you approach the fact that you may be, in fact, industrializing what people now might view as bucolic farmland?
I'll leave that one's for me. actually, we're going through that right now. We don't have any active shale gas programs. But we are involved in the beginnings of the Marcellus, the Haynesville, and then also in West Texas. So we are experiencing a lot of that right now, and it's a very delicate dance that you do because environmentally there's a lot of issues that you have to be very aware of, that you want to make sure you're compliant. There's a lot of learning that goes on both sides, on the company side as to the terrains of the different areas, what some of the local sensitive issues are, and there's a lot of learning on the local community itself, even the regulatory agencies when something like this does occur. So there's a lot of communication, and that's a lot of the stuff that we talked about that goes on behind the scenes that we're doing now, is trying to understand the needs from a regulatory standpoint and balance it with the business decisions that we have to make going forward. So there's not an easy answer to it. It's very complex. There's a lot of coordination. It's very interesting.
Let's go ahead and take some questions. A couple of quick rules. Please say who you are and who you're affiliated with, and hopefully a question, and not just a statement. Thank you. So who's up first? We had one. There's two here.
I'm gonna share this one. On here. I'm gonna disappoint you on the question. But a commentary on how you just phrased your first question there with the characterization of industrialization. CSIS as commentator, you as an instructor and as a commentator and maybe an op-ed writer, I think industrialization is terrifically hyperbolic term to put to developing an area with a lot of... even if the well spacing is fairly tight. I just would ask, plead for a different term than industrialization. Right. That's all. My name is Richard Wallace. I have no affiliation.
I appreciate the comment, and I guess it reflects an important point, which is that different people view industrialization as to mean different things. Got some more questions, several of them now.
Hi, I'm Andrew Dowdy with the State Department. I've seen this as very interesting. Obviously, this changes the gas balance in the United States. And I'm sitting here wondering, there are other major gas consuming regions of the world, and you think at a blush at Eastern Europe, South Asia, parts of Latin America, for example, where if this technology, presuming that the Almighty put some shale there as well, that there might be some potential for some countries to actually change their energy independence or energy security questions. And I was just curious if any of the panelists have looked at exporting this wonderful U.S. technology abroad and maybe some business opportunities there. Thank you.
Yeah, maybe, Brenda, if you could talk a little bit about, I mean, it's really the geological distribution of shales. If you make a comment and then... Ron, if you might want to talk about the international, the export of this technology.
No, I think that's a good point about the resource potential. It's not necessarily where conventional occur. I mean, there's still hydrocarbons, but clearly the geology is different. And I don't think anybody's taken a hard look at the resources there, not even coal bed methane. There are pockets we've looked at. We haven't even, because the data aren't there. We're starting to. We're evaluating the data, but I do think it has a potential to politically change the landscape because they aren't going to be the same areas. And it will certainly be important for those countries, as you say, for more energy security, perhaps energy independence. I know coal bed methane is certainly of interest to countries, and they're starting to be of interest in these others as well, but it's not nearly as developed as the United States.
Okay. Well, I would agree with that. The evidence that we've seen, obviously, some coal bed areas that have really gotten a lot of attention is Australia, India, some of the shale plays that we've mapped out and seen already that exist in Europe, in areas that don't normally have a lot of oil and gas activity. I think the region around Spain in that area has a shale play potential, and of course they're evaluating which shale do they have. Kind of, is this a Barnett class shale? They don't know, but so there are a lot of these plays elsewhere around the globe, and absolutely Halliburton is about taking the technology that we learn in the United States and taking that globally and deploying it for successful commercialization of these properties. A lot of the globe, however, international operations still have some of the what you would term an elephant in terms of productivity of a field. So they haven't come to the place yet in the maturity of their fields that the shale and the coal really grab their attention as large as it does in the United States. But that day will come. And when it comes, you would expect to have some technology to deploy ready to go.
A question here at the front. Yeah, I think you've had your hand up for a while.
I'm Bob Hershey. I'm a consultant. What kinds of research is further needed to get more of the shale and other unconventional resources to be more economical?
Somebody want to go first?
I think everybody has an answer.
Right.
That.
Yeah. So maybe a quick answer from everyone.
Let me try right offhand. Obviously, on our side, there's some very tactical, technical developments that we can do chemically, equipment-wise, just right off the bat. And then when you open the discussion up larger to include a more conservation-type approach, there's a lot of opportunities for technical development in the way that we deploy our conventional fracturing treatments, for example, just as I mentioned in the introduction. So there's a lot of activity that we can engage from the tactical, practical application of stimulation treatments.
And I think there's an upstream research needs of just understanding these resources. They're all very unique. And that then has direct applications to the production, and so I think there's a lot more information needed on the formation, chemically what they are, geologically what they are, understanding that so then it has direct application to everything from mitigation to better development practices so that you minimize that, the water needed, all of those kinds of things, and so that we can do a better estimate of these resources. So to really have a better picture of what is there, what's viable, what's not, what needs more technology versus what may be more easily producible on its own.
Real quickly, there are some areas, too, where we're seeing deeper shales, and right now we're concentrating on what's more it's just actually easier to break the technological code, crack the code on. But there are deeper and there are hotter shale plays out there that we haven't even addressed in any of these that is the future. So once we get this down to where we understand it more, got the more technological hurdles crossed, that's going to be the next level.
I guess if I would just add my views on this, I think that investment in understanding the resource base and is one, it's a continuous effort because your knowledge increases over time, and what we really know about a lot of resource bases in the world is not very much. So I think some investment to understand the resource base also frames potentially the long-term development opportunities, challenges, and the geopolitical aspects of it. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, I am Tony Andrews with the Congressional Research Service. This question, I guess, is addressed to Julie. 1,000 wells is a big number. And if you say I'm going to put 1,000 wells in, I mean, the immediate picture is you're going to have 1,000 drill rigs out there drilling. And I don't think that's really the picture. And the question I'm really asking is how is this staged? Do wells go in or they decommission and new wells are put in? What is the process, if you could elaborate a little bit further?
The preferred path, and actually this is some of the technology things that we're trying to address now, is that you want to do what these called are almost like super pads, and you put in these single pad type developments where you have a drilling rig that will go in and it will drill 6, 8, maybe 12 wells, horizontal wells from one location. not only do you drill from that one location, you actually complete from that one location, and then you have your production from that one location. So it really minimizes the footprint. There's a lot of work still to be done on getting those that are to an economic status, but that is where the industry is heading and looking in the near future. That, I think, addresses a little bit of the industrialization comment, too, which I thought about after the point.
Lou Pularisi with Energy Policy Research Foundation. I have two questions. One is, how serious is the access problem and the regulatory environment? Is that a constraint? And particularly with the new administration, because they've made a lot of Salazar has made some comments. And then the second one is, how fast will you come back if gas prices start to rise? And it's interesting that you move so quickly in a short-term price swings, but
right.
You come back pretty quickly when they...
Well, it depends. It depends on what happens when that price drops. If you have, massive layoffs in the service industries and you're trying to get your crews back, in line, it'll take a while. It'll take a while to rebuild that infrastructure. So you're not going to see it come back as quickly as it went down. Now, your other question was
access.
And if you don't have the maintenance of the reservoir, you have to bring that all back up, too.
Correct. She's correct. Access, it's more difficult and it's more expensive. So it is a constraint. So in reality, what it ends up doing is that when you look at it from a business perspective, it makes it more difficult to reach the thresholds that you need. So it's just another added. It in essence has the same effect as having a lower gas price because you have a higher cost associated with it, and it takes longer to get things done, which influences your payout. So it doesn't destroy a project, but it does deteriorate the economics, and potentially in some projects it may destroy.
Question at the back.
Hi, Rhonda Fahmy-Udome with FHI. I am interested in some statistics regarding the quality of gas here in the U.S. My understanding is a majority of it is sour, and whether or not there's any technologies to be able to sweeten that.
From the service side of it, of course, we're aware of if we're dealing with a sour gas reservoir versus a sweet gas because of the safety issues. So I'm not speaking from a study, but just looking at our crews going out, we're not working on that many sour gas wells. So I would challenge the premise. I don't think the majority is sour at all, and I think I would put a big challenge on that, just watching operations.
Yeah, I don't have the numbers in front of me. I'd have to go back and look, but that's not my impression either. I think some are very viable.
And just speaking from our perspective, one company's perspective, we don't have we have a small percentage of sour gas that we actually produce and deal with. And believe me, we would know because it is a lot more manpower intensive.
Now, it may be that those being produced are the sweeter, but of the ones we've all looked at, I think they're all pretty good.
Yeah, mostly we're dealing with sweet gas, by far and away, the majority.
I mean, it helps with the economics. It's partly why it's...
Any services delivered on a sour gas unit are more costly, more intensive. You would know it if you're engaged in a sour gas activity.
Got a question over here.
My name's Bob Linden. I'm with the Pace Global Energy Services. I want to ask a rather mundane question about the demobilization and remobilization costs, but given where we are today, I want to put it in a strategic and international context. My clients are some major gas producers, major LNG producers, and large midstream infrastructure developers around the world. Over the past 10 years, we've probably seen north of $100 billion go into LNG liquefaction projects and transportation projects, whole vertical value chains targeted at the U.S. market. A lot of these are coming on in the next 5 years. Some are already on. Now, an LNG plant has economics completely different from what we just saw. It basically, you spend $10 billion, you throw a switch, and the thing runs for 30 to 50 years, depending on how much you got from the ground to do it. The marginal costs of producing that LNG are reasonably low in the overall thing. The big nut pays the big capital cost up front. It does not require a lot of any investment. These projects are coming on. The world economy has slowed down. And I have people coming to me every day saying, what's the market for LNG going to be? Well, we're entering this wild dynamic right now where we've got these low marginal cost LNG plants. They're trying to recover the capital. They're shoving LNG into the market. And we're getting to the point of saturation. At the same time, we've had this boom in shale gas production here in the United States. Your economics are very different, as you've laid out. You've got to keep pumping money in. So we have this fight in terms of where the price is going to settle out at any given point in time between growing dump sales of LNG suppliers and the need to continually reinvest in our shale production. So getting back to my rather mundane question, you're going through a period of relative demobilization right now, and remobilization is going to happen as soon as the market, global market for LNG tightens up. We get some kind of equilibrium. The screws get applied in terms of import costs, and all of a sudden it's profitable to produce the drill and produce shale gas again. How does that kind of up and down process, which might have a cycle of perhaps 3 years, 5 years, I don't know, affect the overall economics? Are there very high price to pay for demobilization and remobilization, or is it more modest and we shouldn't be focusing too much on it?
Well, there's definitely a loss in efficiency, and all the economics we show up here, and again, those are very generic economics, but they're assumed on having smooth efficiency, so there's not any disruptions, that your 450 is your 450 for life and your 650 is your 650 for life, and we all know that's not the way it works. So you will have disruptions, and it will impact your overall return. I think, you know, the thing that we hope for in the future is that there will be more demand for gas, more domestic demand for gas, you know, which means that we have to change maybe some of the ways that we're doing things now, right, which is going to hopefully help stabilize gas prices at a level that companies are very comfortable with committing to investment long term. It is a multifaceted issue.
But that I think that brings up the an issue I raised at the beginning. That is, the competition and the market structures that materialize around major new sources. For example, major pipelines from the Arctic would create a different environment. If you've thought about that, what is your view about what that would do to the unconventional gas plays?
Well, it's going to be competition. And again, if we don't have the marketplace to where the demand has increased for the natural gas, it's going to have a very negative effect, I think, on the shale gas plays. It depends on which market is going to be able to get their gas to the consumer cheaper, and that's the market that's going to win, whether it be the Arctic pipeline or whether it be the shale gas plays.
Other questions?
The last question is that arguably these sorts of opportunities are much more commercially resilient than, say, LNG. In LNG, you've committed billions of dollars to a development, to a regas terminal. With shale gas, that's not the case. What you're doing is you're phasing your investment. Basically, 80% of most of these projects is Drillex. And so you drill a number of wells, and if the price of gas goes down, you basically back off drilling, which is exactly what we're seeing in the United States right now. So the market response to the gas price with regards to shale gas to me seems very makes a lot of sense. And I would just throw out to the panel that dimension of these unconventional opportunities, that you're phasing capital, is really a very attractive dimension economically and commercially. It's a little different from actually the cash flow profile you showed. I challenge that maybe one would do it a little differently.
It's very difficult to, you know, what we're seeing in the price environment. You're right, it will respond, you know, the programs will respond to the price. But it's the volatility and the steepness of the price differences we see that really hurt a lot of the projects. And when you see such a steep decline in gas prices, and it makes it such a difficult decision, and some companies, you know, laying off, et cetera, it is a much more dramatic impact. If it were like this, we'd all be very happy. But when it's like this, That's what makes it really difficult.
Right, but the point I'd make is you looking forward then, as the price drops, you're backing off your drilling. Mm-hmm. You haven't made a commitment like you would in a deep water project where everything is up front. If the gas price drops,
right.
You're stuck.
Right. It's not nearly as deep. There are commitments to marketing infrastructures, firm transportation. There's things that we do make commitments to. Right. Long-term rig contracts. Lots of things that are in there, but it's not necessarily the magnitude of an LNG-sized plant.
I think that's an important point because there is a response time then to the unconventional plays, which is different than an Arctic development or a major LNG development or even a major deep water. So in that sense, it fits in a different space with respect to the ability to respond, although it does take time to gear up, especially if you've dismantled the support infrastructure. Another question over here? Fell on the front spin. Oh, yeah. And then you next.
Mike Morrow, Riverside Research. One quick question on the art of the possible for the lateral lines for the horizontal drilling on exactly how far. I know in the Barnett Shale, I know the running line's roughly 7,000 feet or so. And then a second question on some of the urban drilling. I know in the Barnett Shale that right now they're drilling and capping just because of the leases that they had in play when they started. They want to get the wells down and are putting caps on it. So I suspect that's primarily because the price is going down and such. But you know, with the reference back to your highway and the off-ramps is whether they may or may not come back, you know, an awful lot of that's in the urban areas there in Tarrant County, which I think might be kind of novel. It's not all up in Denton and other places. The sweet spot happens to be right there over a highly populated area, and that's why they're paying $20,000 an acre and stuff for some of that stuff. But does that mean that the investment is now high enough that they're going to come back and uncap those wells and produce because they got so much sunk cost into some of those wells?
I'm not sure I'm the right one to address that since we're not in that particular situation. But I believe it's going to be just a case of economics and when the capital costs really start to come back down relative to gas price, when it makes it economic to uncap those wells and start producing them again. So each company is going to have an individual threshold for that.
So do you think that 650 range is that range where it was, was that point where it was productive for them to continue to put in pipelines and try to get it out to market versus in a 450 range where they're tending to just cap the wells? And obviously they want to get the rigs in and close on the leases so that those things don't expire.
Right. Internally, I don't know what specific gas price that they're targeting. You know, one thing we didn't bring up, though, as well, is that we showed the Barnett and we looked at 450 and 650 just as very simple scenarios, but each gas play is going to have a very different gas threshold. In some of the deeper ones, the higher pressure, you know, that Ron was showing, it's going to be a higher gas price threshold that it takes for them to
And then the length of the lines?
The length of the horizontal. There's a lot of technology globally about how far you can drill horizontally. Take a look at the Saudi Arabia work for extended horizontals. Take a look, for example, Sakhalin Island development, where basically you were working on an offshore environment, but the rigs were sitting onshore and an extremely extended lateral to lower the overall cost and not be offshore in that harsh environment. So there's a lot of technology about horizontal extension. But again, the warning is, for example, Sakhalin Island was not a shale. And so a lot of the things you take for granted mechanically that you can accomplish, you do them in a shale and you have a reaction that you weren't counting on, and maybe exposure to a drilling fluid on the shale deteriorates the shale after a period of time. And what's the time and how fast can you drill? There's a ton of complications that can arise. Mechanically, a lot of things can be done, just like we fractured the shale, the Barnett Shale, in the 80s. I know. I was there. And it was not successful in terms of production. So there's a lot of mechanical things you can do, but it won't necessarily mean they're successful production-wise. So that's a complicated issue. The aerial extent, the efficiency of drainage, the patterns that will ultimately come out to be the most efficient, all those things will drive. Mechanically, how far can I go horizontally? A long way. But is it the right answer for the shale that you're playing in? And just because you get that answer in the Barnett, may not be the same number you get in the Woodford.
John Casebolt, intern at CSIS here. It's kind of an unfair question, but increased efficiency in drilling when we've got a surplus isn't going to help the market any. Do you know of any advances on the other side of the dollar sign as far as demand that are being developed? I'm a lot more interested in that 0.18 than I am the 0.04.
Yeah.
Depends upon who you ask. T. Boone Pickens thinks we should change all our vehicles to natural gas. So there are some suggestions out there.
Just trucks and buses is clear.
Trucks and buses. That's still a challenge. So there. Exactly. So you're right. But there are some things, and I think that's being discussed. That's a good point. But I'm just wondering if all the challenges are also being discussed.
Well, I think one of the keys too is that that you know, looking forward, the current time, which is a struggle, it's a struggle in many dimensions because of the economy. Over time, I think almost everyone believes this is not going to be the challenge. Will be producing enough. You're still facing a position where the growing demand, particularly because of the attractiveness of gas, and it's, you know, it's a multidimensional, it's a multi-use molecule, and so I think that most people would feel that the longer term issue is going to be able to maintain the production that you need and get the resources to the demand centers. Near term, I think we're in a different environment. But long term, I think it's going to be every molecule counts, and so that's not going to be as much. At least that's, I think, the view of many many people look out there. Question here.
Hi, I'm Dan Witten with Bloomberg News, and I really hate to ask this question, but I wondered if you all could comment a little bit on whether Pickens' plan to put gas in, whether it be all trucks and buses or cars generally, given the resources available, is a legitimate plan.
We have a comment. Let's go with the first comment to the comment from the audience. I will follow with the comment.
These are supply and reservoir and resource people. They're not demand side folks. But maybe I can. We can pin them down. I can help with Bloomberg. Does anybody on the panel drive a natural gas vehicle?
Nope.
All right. I'm on the bus.
Let me make a couple of comments on this. First, one of the challenges about using natural gas as a substitute for liquid fuel is the physics issue. A cubic foot of gasoline has the same energy as 1,000 cubic feet of methane. So even when you compress it, you've got about a 4-to-1 energy density disadvantage. That means for a fixed amount of volume on the vehicle, you only have a fourth as much energy, which translates generally into a range issue. For large vehicles, and we see them here in the city, buses, you can overcome this because it's a big enough vehicle, you can add enough storage that seems to be useful. But in the end, one has to ask about the transport infrastructure that we have today built around gas or liquid fuels, gasolines, diesels, and even ethanol, for example, biofuels, is built around the fact that it's easy to store at standard temperatures and pressures in relatively inexpensive storage materials, and it has very high density, energy density. And that, in my view, has driven the structure of the transport infrastructure and the fueling infrastructure. And if you're going to go to a lower energy density fueling system, it's going to have significant alterations in that infrastructure. So does that mean it but for things where vehicles come home at night, like municipal transport systems, fleet systems, such an infrastructure is clearly manageable, and it, because it exists all over the world.
Did your grandfather ever get on to you for hammering a nail with a pair of pliers? The hammer is valuable and the pliers are valuable, but you don't get confused about which tool to what problem.
Maybe we need another question. We've got one back here in the middle.
Thank you. My name is William Christensen. I'm from the Norwegian Embassy. I'm interested in the sort of the environmental concerns with tight gas. And I wonder if you can comment a little bit on the water concerns and other environmental concerns with regard to production, and if that is possible, that, you know, a showstopper for some of the areas that you have tight gas. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that the comment for those who didn't hear clearly is about concerns about water use, issues with respect to encountering in your drilling and production activities aquifers, so there's potential contamination, and emissions in general and energy use in general about this type of development. For example, we haven't heard anybody ask the question about if you, going forward, you had a price on carbon, which means, or directly in terms of energy, how would that play out in this development versus other kinds of activities?
I'll address the water issue first. The water issues are going to take several different solutions. I don't think you're going to have one size that fits all for any shale play. Even within one, any shale play, you're going to have recycling, which I think is going to be very important once we can get that to a technologically and a commercially acceptable stage. There's treatments, you know, there's downhole injection in some of the deeper formations. So there's different avenues that you can take, but to say that one is going to solve all your problems on the disposal part is difficult. So we're going to have to use a combination of that, and that's also going to help, especially on the recycling with the sourcing issue.
I think for carbon, you know, it's interesting. If we undertake, and we could be anybody, United States, Europe, anybody, carbon sequestration as a viable use for carbon dioxide, I think some of these things will go into resource competition. If you're going to put that those water reject into other saline formations or other reservoirs, and that may start to compete with carbon dioxide. So it's an interesting thing that we haven't started thinking about yet, and Norway is obviously leading the way. But if you then are starting to have all these other produced waters, it may start to compete for those reservoirs. As far as the carbon tax thing, and again, these are just ideas to think about. I don't think anybody has the answer. If you do implement a carbon tax, suddenly coal becomes much more expensive, and you have to offset electrical generation with something else. Now, there's renewables, there's geothermal, there's other things. But at how much? For your same reason of density or energy density, natural gas is just the one that's right there. It's going to take a lot of things if we truly offset or pay the cost of coal. So, I mean, it just gets very complex.
Yeah, I think one of the clear strengths for natural gas is in use is, it's again, this multidimensional, multi-use molecule, is the fact that it is really one of your few choices where you can have a fuel that can be used to quickly ramp up or ramp down power production. Baseload power runs baseload. The addition of new of renewables, which are variable but may not be controllable, in a sense, gas is the complement to that. And you see that in many utilities, which allows you to do the balancing. So gas is may perhaps unique in that, in the sense that you can store large volumes of energy, you can bring them on, ramp them up quickly. So that's a dimension of natural gas as you go to a world which has much bigger renewable but variable content. Do we have any more questions? We have one. Frank.
From a policy standpoint, I have the reverse side to an earlier question. So over the last 18 months, we've stopped construction on, depending on whose count you take, between 40 and 50 new coal plants, right? We probably can't scale up nuclear or renewables in time. If demand grows quickly, natural gas is the peak and baseload substitute. If you go into, in the near term, a sub-$4 world, And so we start suspending drilling on some of these projects, and we take a surplus back into a deficit. Do we have a gap that we're dealing with? How quickly do we come out of the gap?
How quickly do we come out of the gap? Depends on how severe the drop was and how long the drop lasted. So it's really hard for me to try to answer that, not knowing if we fall below sub four, how long we stay below sub four. If it's for a short period of time, we ought to be able to rebound fairly quickly. If it's for a couple of years or so, I think you're going to see a much more, it's a higher magnitude impact and a longer time to make up that gap. It's almost like you need a crystal ball of some sort to try to help to predict, you know, what the responses are going to be, but until you know what the actual reality is on the demand side in the near term, it's hard. Sorry to avoid it.
I'm Matt Frank from CSIS. I think it was embedded in one of the last questions, but wasn't quite directly answered, so I wonder if I could just pose it again and see if there are any comments. Is there a difference in the emissions profile of producing shale or CBM as compared to other conventional sources? And I understand that, you know, each play is different. You're doing your fracturing a little differently, and that's the, you know, extra emissions intensive step or the extra energy intensive step, which might result in greater emissions. But is there any experience that we've had that shows how much greater that intensity might be?
From the application part of it, no. For example, just like I said in my presentation, if you drive by a location and look at the equipment on location, it looks the same. So our footprint looks the same whether I'm dealing with a shale or a coal bed or a tight or carbonate, a tight sand or a carbonate. So from the application side of it, I'm sure the drilling rig is not my background, but I'm sure it looks pretty much the same too. So on that side, the footprint doesn't change.
We have time for one or two more questions, if there are any. I don't see any more. I'd just like to thank everybody for coming and their participation. I particularly want to thank the panelists, if we could give them a round of applause for their effort. I also specifically want to acknowledge Matt Frank for putting this together, and appreciate his efforts. And the slides are available on csis.org. So thank you very much.